Blog Talk Radio.
Let's go on. I've got some news for you.
Yeah, I was trying to get up here, but man, oh man, I'll tell you. It really rough. I got there's some stuff going on that nobody really seems to know about. I didn't know about it. I didn't know that that there were so many strikes and so going on around the world. And we're trying to, we try to keep some kind of semblance to this, but there's so many places. But in American news and blogs, forget about it. You don't hear about European things happening, and you don't even hear about it in the stuff that the Europeans send you, like Financial Times and so on and so forth. But here on mail.uk, of course, here we go again. That's not happening. Oh, do I hate this? Okay, hang on. For some reason, this thing is... I wanted it to.
Because you touched something and it's supposed to be...
Well, you know what? You can touch this thing all you want because it's not going to do much. I'm trying to get this article up and all of a sudden it just disappears.
What's the article?
It's right here. Right there. Tell me why it's not. There it is. Okay. It's called The Case Against Europe. MEP Daniel Hannan reveals the disturbing contempt for the democracy at the heart of the EU. I thought it was interesting to bring this up tonight because you don't hear a lot about this yet. I hear about the EU and stuff, but, you know, there is so much dissent going on around the country and throughout Europe based on this, but you're not hearing about it anywhere, you know? There is a popular joke in Brussels that if the European Union were a country applying to join itself, it would be rejected on the grounds of being undemocratic. It's absolutely true, and believe me, it isn't funny. This machine is such a...
No, Leo. It
knocked me right out of the article. Just get rid of that article. Not the article. Get rid of that one. Here, you read that and don't touch anything.
Over 13 years as an MEP, David Hanahan has witnessed firsthand how Brussels works, and Leo read this. There is a popular joke in Brussels that if the European Union were a country applying to join itself, it would be rejected on the grounds of being undemocratic. It is absolutely true, and believe me, it isn't funny. Or if it is, then the laugh is on you and me. Democracy is not simply a periodic right to mark a cross on a ballot paper. It also depends on the relationship between the government and the governed, on a sense of common affinity and allegiance. It requires what the political philosophers of ancient Greece called demos, a unit with which we the people can identify. Take away the demos and you are left only with the keratos, a state that must compel by force of law what if it cannot ask in the name of patriotism. In the absence of demos, governments are even likelier than usual to purchase votes through public works schemes. Lacking any natural loyalty, they have to buy the support of their electorate. And that is precisely what is happening in the EU. One way to think of the EU is as a massive vehicle for the redistribution of wealth, though not in a way that many of us would consider fair or beneficial. Taxpayers in all states contribute money to Brussels through their national taxes. The bureaucrats then use this huge revenue to purchase the allegiance of consultants, contractors, big landowners, non-government organizations, corporations, charities, and municipalities. In other words, all the articulate and powerful groups they rely on to keep themselves in employment. Unsurprisingly, the people running the EU have little time for the concept of representative government. The unelected president of the European Commission, José Manuel Barroso, argues that nation states are dangerous precisely because they are excessively democratic. Decisions taken by the most democratic institutions in the world are very often wrong, he claims, without a hint of irony. The plain fact is that the EU is contemptuous of public opinion, not by some oversight, but as an inevitable consequence of its supernatural national nature. The EU is run extraordinarily by a body that combines legislative and executive power. The European Commission is not only the EU's government, it is also the only body that can propose legislation in most fields of policy. Such a concentration of power is in itself objectionable enough, but what is even more terrifying is that the 27 commissioners are unelected. Many supporters of the EU acknowledge this flaw, the democratic deficit, as they call it, and vaguely admit that something ought to be done about it. But the democratic deficit isn't an accidental design flaw. It is intrinsic to the whole project. The EU's founding fathers had mixed feelings about democracy, especially the populist strand that came into vogue between the two worlds. In their minds, too much democracy was associated with demagoguery and fascism. They prided themselves on creating a model where superpower would be in the hands of experts, disinterested technocrats immune to the ballot box.
Yeah, right.
They understood very well that their audacious scheme to merge Europeans' ancient kingdoms and republics into a single state would never succeed if each successive transfer of power from the nation's capitals to Brussels had to be approved by the voters. They were unapologetic about designing a system in which public opinion would come second to deals stuck by the Bureau of Wise Men. The EU's diffidence about representative government continues to this day. When a referendum goes the wrong way, the Eurocrats simply swat the results aside. Denmark voted against the Maastricht Treaty in 1992, Ireland against the Nice Treaty in 2001, and Ireland again against the Lisbon Treaty in 2008. The governments were all told to just go away and try again. When France and Netherlands voted against the European Constitution in 2005, the verdict was simply disregarded. As an MEP at the time, I well remember the aftermath of those last two votes. One after the other, MEPs and Eurocrats rose to explain that people hadn't really been voting against the European Constitution at all. They had actually been voting against Anglo-Saxon capitalism or the French leader Jacques Chirac or against Turkey joining. Anything, in fact, except the proposition actually on the ballot. As in any abusive relationship, the contemptuous way in which Eurocrats treat voters has become self-reinforcing on both sides. The more voters are ignored, the more cynical and fatalistic they become. They abstain in record numbers, complaining, quite understandably, that it makes no difference how they cast their ballots. Eurocrats, for their part, fall quickly into the habit of treating public opinion as an obstacle to overcome rather than a reason to change direction. So they're having a hard time with that. This is quite a long article.
Much
too long to read today. But you can go to this. Let me see what it says right at the end. You know what? The end is a long way away.
It's mail online.
Oh, here it is. They talk in the last paragraph about the real power. Let's just listen to this. The real power of the EU is to be found in the wider corpus of interested parties, the businesses invested in the regulatory process, the consultant and the contractors dependent on Brussels spending, the landowners receiving checks from the common agricultural policy, the local councils with their EU departments, the seconded civil servants with their remuneration terms beyond anything they could hope for in their home countries, the armies of lobbyists and professional associates, the charities and the NGOs. Here is the swollen European behemoth. It is its interests utterly tied into the European project, and I fear it is not going to stand aside for a cause so trivial as public opinion or democracy.
That was written by an MEP, a member of the English Parliament. How do we get back?
We'll give people where it came from so they can go to it.
I already did. Mail Online.
Go to Mail Online and you can...
UK, I believe it.
And it's a very long article, but it just shows how cumbersome the European government is, that European Union. Unelected bureaucrats being bought off.
Yeah.
That's all. And not listening, the votes of the individual countries don't seem to mean anything at all.
No, just like the United States.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Yeah, so you were talking about strikes. What about the, where are the strikes
all over
listed?
The world. They're actually in that article. If you saw all those pictures, the articles were in there, and the captions. They're in France, Greece, Spain, Belgium.
People are demonstrating against
all the strikes, and they're striking and they're demonstrating, and they're violently demonstrating in some cases. You know? So it's like the next article I got is the Zionist drive for greater Israel. And I thought this was kind of interesting.
Do you have anything specific to the Union to read tonight?
No, I don't. Not really. Well, I do, but unfortunately, with this computer, I can't bookmark it because it doesn't bookmark. All right, and I do have one, but I have to get out of this website, go into another one, and then go back into this website. Not because I can't bookmark. Can you explain that, Lana? Why this is not bookmarked?
I have no idea.
I don't know why. I mean, it's one of these ridiculous...
All you have to do is go there, and then it's in the history, and then you just hit it.
That's
and it
not
comes
true.
Up.
That's not true at all. Because you can go into this history, and it brings up history I've never even seen before. Okay. So it's like, I don't...
You want me to show you how to do it?
Why don't you do it? And,
did you go to that? Did you go to that site?
Yes.
Today?
Yes. But you know what? It's not in the bookmarks.
Well, it's not going to be in bookmarks. It's going to be in history.
Oh. Okay. This is history.
Okay, let me show you.
Okay. We're going to wait until Lila brings up the amazing article from the FLCIO.
Yeah, I never had bookmarks on mine. Earlier today.
Yeah. No. No. It didn't even know. Nothing. There we go. Wait a minute. There it is. Here it is.
Alabama AFL-CIO?
Yeah, but it's not really that one. Forgive us, folks, because we're really just trying to break. I got one computer down, one slow, and one that I don't understand at all. So hang on one second. New stories for you.
Bear with us. Leo doesn't really understand how to use this computer, and I've only used it
100 times, but we're just learning. AFL-CIO calls for national boycotts of Palermo's.
Of what?
Palermo's.
And what is that?
It is a brand of pizza.
Oh, okay.
Okay. The AFL-CIO has called for a nationwide boycott of Milwaukee-based Palermo Villa, Inc., which is embroiled in a labor dispute. The boycott covers Palermo's brand pizza, Classics brand pizza, and private label brand frozen pizza produced by Palermo, including Costco's Kirkland brand. The national union's endorsement of the boycott is part of its continued support for the efforts of the Palermo Workers Union by the United Steelworkers and the AFL-CIO community and the immigrants' rights groups such as Voces de la Frontera and students from this United States Association, the nation's largest and oldest student-led organization. The 12 million union families of the AFL-CIO are proud to stand with these Wisconsin workers who have bravely joined together for a voice on the job. AFL-CIO President Richard Chumka said, "Their courage and strength are a model of working people around the country whose rights are being violated and voices silenced. We hope that this boycott will encourage Palermo to finally respect its workers who work so hard for them every day." And Milwaukee workers at Palermo have been on strike since June 1st to protest alleged unfair labor practices by the company. The company has denied engaging in any unfair labor practices, but the National Labor Board is reviewing the allegations against the company.
Does it say what the allegations are?
Yeah, it says that issued the following statement. The situation at Palermo is a result of an investigation initiated by the United States Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, determined that some employees are ineligible to work in the United States. The audit that we compiled is one of thousands of immigration enforcement actions that have been undertaken by the federal government and companies across the country. Palermo's cooperated with ICE and obeyed the law. The baseless allegations made against Palermo's represent a pattern of deception and obfuscation that is designed to harm our company. And this is from a company spokesman, in reaction to the boycott. And the baseless allegations made against Palermo represent a pattern of deception and obfuscation that is designed to harm our company, our employees, and our community. The working conditions as described by the protesters seeking to organize a union at Palermo are false and only serve to harm an actual of workers employed at the company now.
So they're obstructing the formation of
a
union.
Right. In particular, the allegations about employee time off, workplace safety, and unhealthy people working in our factory are not true. As our annual third-party audits prove, attempts to boycott Palermo are an intimidation tactic being used to force the resolution of a labor dispute, but into motion by an organization demanding that Palermo violate federal immigration law. The union vote is completely dependent on a date that will be determined by the National Labor Relations Board. We will continue to have a fact-based discussion with our workers and provide accurate information to help those voting to make an informed decision. We will continue to adhere to all NLRB
National Labor Relations Board
procedures and guidelines as we move toward a vote. Palermo's has a long history of respecting its employees, their safety and well-being, paying a competitive wage, blah, 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 blah. Okay, numerous charities, and they bleed. This company bleeds for the community. But the endorsement by the AFL-CIO does not include financial support. But it does bring the issue to the attention of the union board nationwide base of members and affiliates, says Christine Newman Ortiz. To us, this is very important because there is a lot of union members and more socially conscious consumers that are Costco members. And Costco has not yet responded to the Palermo Workers Union's request to stop ordering Palermo products. Boycott events are planned for Costco locations in Middletown, Grafton, New York City, Los Angeles, Gary, Indiana, Portland, Montgomery, Alabama, Washington, D.C., and Pittsburgh this weekend. Cesar Fernandez, a line leader at Palermo, who has been leading the strike since June 1st, said the strikers continue to picket in front of Palermo and Costco, and the support of the National Labor Association organization has helped encourage those on strike, he said. It gives us more strength in our boycott campaign to have the support of the National AFL-CIO. It also inspires us to keep fighting. Amanda says, we haven't given up. We're going to continue to see this to the end. So I don't really know what that didn't really say what the issues were to the extent that what they're doing, you know. But did you get an article what the actual issues were?
Well, I thought they were saying that they were obstructing the formation of a union.
That's what it sounds like. That's what it appears to be.
But there's a complaint by the before the National Labor Relations Board about something.
Yeah, saying that they're unhealthy workers and so I'm not really sure.
So the working conditions sound like there's
a
problem.
They're not as good as
they should be.
Yeah.
But I think the article could have been a little clearer about and talk more about the problems.
Yeah.
I mean, instead of being a mouthpiece for the Palermo Pizza saying...
Yeah, that's what I didn't quite understand.
Yeah, that article wasn't very clear. I'd like to... What are you doing?
I'm trying to get back to where we were. And maybe if we go there...
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if we go there,
that's right.
And maybe we can go down a little more. Oh, okay. But anyway, that was something that I had on the news, AFL News, and you can check out other stuff on the AFL-CIO site .org, AFL-CIO.org.
So you know, the mainstream news doesn't give union issues any attention at all because they're run by corporations.
Because they're run by corporations.
And they certainly don't present the side that needs to be heard, that workers very often are being screwed.
Yeah, the only guy...
And they're being denied their rights.
Yeah. Yeah. The only guy that stood for unions was Ed Schultz, was talking about unions and trying to bring people on. But you know they
quickly got rid of him.
Well, they got rid of him, then they brought him back, then they put him on at 10 or 11 o'clock at night on MSNBC, which nobody watches.
Yeah.
So it's like,
but he was quite good and quite vocal about that kind of stuff,
vocal about it.
Which was great. At least you got some sense of what was happening. But we don't get MSNBC, so we don't hear that
anymore. Yeah. I don't really miss it, but not at all.
I did like listening to him, though.
Yeah, you get a lot to say. I thought this was an interesting article, too. This Philadelphia woman faces $600 a day fine for feeding needy neighborhood kids.
Bizarre. Yeah.
A Pennsylvania woman who offered free lunch every day to low-income children in her neighborhood faced a $600 a day fine next summer if she continues because she did not clear the food giveaway with township officials. And Angela Prentice donates her time to distribute the meals supplied by the Archdiocese of Philadelphia and adheres to strict paperwork, like filling out weekly reports and being visited bi-weekly from a state worker. My FoxPhilly.com reports, and but yet there's still a problem here. And
what does it say?
I'm going to this. This article is from the trenches. Little report.
Got to speak up there.
I said it's the article is from the trenches. WorldReport.com. It as a way to contribute to the community in a positive way, and Ayala, member of the Archdiocese, said there was nothing in it for her. And Prattis laughed and said, "I don't make a dime." And Prattis lived in the township for 3 years. She reportedly distributes the meals to the 60 or so children at a gazebo on our property during the summer months when children are home from school. The Delaware County Times reported that another resident alerted the council about the distribution a few weeks ago. A council investigated and ruled the practice is not permitted without a variance, the paper reported. You have houses here, the roofs are falling in, and they could be focused on a lot of more serious issues than me feeding children each, she said. Just the township, which has a per capita income of $19,000 a year, says Prattis lives in a residential zone. Hence, handing out food to children is not allowed. and the township says she needs to go before a zoning board to ask for a variance, which would cost her up to $1,000 in administrative fees. And she says, I don't think it's my responsibility to go to her to say, why don't you come to talk to me and see if there's something that we can do to help your program, William Passaic, the township, Chester Township business manager said. Well, Prattis told the Delaware County Times that she is not going to stop feeding the children in the area. So there you go. All right? So what do you think about it?
Well, I think it's a lot of paperwork BS.
Yeah, and she's going to spend $1,000 to go before the board and something like this?
It's ridiculous.
It's craziness. That's absolute insanity.
I'm sure she doesn't live in a neighborhood that's complaining. Sounds like a very poor neighborhood if there's 60 kids without food.
Yeah, and she feeds them in the summer because they don't have school lunches. Unbelievable, huh?
Now, in a lot of areas, and Torrington, which is a city near us, they provide school lunches in the summer.
Really? What provides it?
There's a school in Torrington that provides school lunches in the summer because the kids are hungry.
Yeah, yeah.
And I actually spoke to the town social worker where I work about something for next summer. I'm concerned about our kids, who we have a lot of kids on free lunch, and they need that.
And they're not eating.
They have breakfast and they have lunch at our school. Those are two. That's two meals a day. Macroeconomy continues with 12 million unemployed in more than 40 million low-income households. Since late 2007, nearly 4 million Americans lost their homes, unable to make their mortgage payment, and approximately 1.6 million children were at some point living in the street with a quality of life near the poverty level. That's kind of scary, isn't it, folks?
Yeah. And this is what the Republicans want. This is the kind of world they want.
Yeah, well, it's more money. It's more money for the rich at the top.
They want nobody to have work or jobs, but they don't want anybody to live or eat or breathe or have any medical care either. There's a lot of talk on the internet now lately about a major virus hitting the banks, okay, and shutting down all the banks. And this may happen in October, which would be, according to Max Kaiser, who's a Russian TV commentator, he says that it's going to happen, and it's supposed to happen by April 2013, all right? And that's the plan of the bankers. So I don't know. I won't read that.
Go ahead, Neil.
Oh. Okay.
Do you have an audio piece?
No, I don't. Because this doesn't play audio.
Yes, it does.
Well, for some reason, it does not play the audio on this site. We will try. The reason I wanted to bring this up is it says why you should root for the maniac with a knife if war is a crime. Leave it to us to take the side of the stoned and knife-wielding maniac against the cops. At TDV, we call the U.S. one of the most dangerous places in the world, as I did in yesterday's post. Are we employing hyperbole just to make our case against the USSA? Nope. Odds are that a U.S. citizen or resident will do at least three things per day that could get you locked up in a federal prison for years. That's because politicians and regulators constantly come up with laws designed to legislate every behavior and transaction imaginable. Furthermore, the U.S. boasts an army of increasingly aggressive of state-sanctioned domestic soldiers who are more than willing to gun you down if you resist their attempted kidnapping for breaking one of the countless stupid rules. Even as we were putting together yesterday's issue, Darius Kennedy was getting gunned down by cops in New York Times Square. Headlines immediately pointed out that Mr. Kennedy was a deranged knife-wielding man, and that's true. But we're going to have to take Mr. Kennedy's side in this. After all, he was just defending himself from a bunch of sanctioned criminals in uniforms that he pulled with that knife. Police initially approached him because he was smoking something that looked like a marijuana cigarette. Right there, many of the mouth-breathing status in the U.S. will conclude that Mr. Kennedy deserved to be shot, or at least kidnapped by government enforcers for ignoring prohibition laws about what he can put in his body. But why in the world is it illegal to smoke pot at all? Why do costumed attack dogs have the right to kidnap you for non-crimes? Well, even if Mr. Kennedy was deranged, he still can't blame him. What rational person would let a little crazy thing in a fascist police state like the U.S., especially in the United Nations, in that nation's most oppressive city? I don't know. I'm gonna send you to it so you can read the whole thing, because they got a legitimate gripe, I think. And
it's just not very well written.
And it's called War is a Crime, Gary Gibbon. and the dollar vigilante or something. But I think you should check it out.
What's the site?
War is a Crime.
Okay.
Right? Check that out. It's kind of a fun article if you, you know, if you're into that type of thing. So I'm going to let you pick one, dear. Okay.
Blacklisting firms should be made to pay compensation for years lost and years in future. They should be made to employ blacklisted workers or not be awarded any public government-backed contracts. An apology in the national press and to individuals whose life they ruined would be a start. So,
pretty scary, huh?
Yeah.
What they can do to those poor people. And,
yeah.
You know, even, and what they can do now, you know. It's just the retaliation,
Eli Lilly admits to more than $200 million worth of doctor payoff.
Let's read that a little bit.
Prozac, Cialis, Cymbalta. If you have a television or read magazines, you've heard of their drugs. Eli Lilly out of Indiana makes billions of dollars every year off the sale of their patented chemicals, which he used to suppress the symptoms of disease in the human body. Founded by a chemist in the late 19th century, today the pharmaceutical giant has offices in 18 countries, and its products are sold in 125 countries, with revenues exceeding $20 billion annually. Most of their arsenal is available in other countries for much less money than it is here in the United States, as is the case with most prescription medication. The reason the pharmaceutical industry claims is that the healthcare systems of other countries demand affordable medication, and they need somebody somewhere to put the research bill so they can get the next patents lined up before others expire, allowing generic versions of their drugs to become available on the market. That leaves us Americans with our broken healthcare system footing the bill of their continued financial success.
Sick. You didn't show where they're paying off the doctors. Read that part.
Oh, yeah. I just didn't go to that. We're not only footing the bill, we have to deal with how pharmaceutical machines warps the medical system. While historically a trade secret, it is standing operating procedure for pharmaceutical giants to pay doctors and other healthcare professionals to promote their drugs. Seducing doctors into becoming mouthpieces for a share of their bottom line is where it begins, but it ends up dictating your options. Beginning in 2012, all drug and medical device companies will be required to report their promotional expenditure numbers to the federal government, but several companies started disclosing their information in 2009. According to the disclosed information, last year Eli Lilly paid out more than $200 million in payments to doctors and healthcare providers for promoting their drugs. ProPublica.org's Dollars for Docs database is tracking 11 other company disclosures as well. The reason this information has been disclosed in Eli Lilly's case is because Eli Lilly was involved in a criminal settlement and was ordered to disclose these payments since 2009. They agreed to pay $1.4 billion to settle criminal and civil allegations of promoting drugs for unapproved uses. And we read that last night. An official from the FDA in court testified how Eli Lilly concealed the risk of its schizophrenia drug Zyprexa from U.S. officials, knowing the serious health risks it caused. They defrauded Medicare and Medicaid and blatantly put profit over the concern of the consumer.
Yeah, that's a typical pharmaceutical company there. No? So, anyway, let us go on. We've got about 10 minutes left. Let's see what we got here. This has bothered me so much, okay? That I have to read it. An Oregon man is convicted of collecting rainwater on his own property and surrenders and begins serving a 30-day jail sentence. Maybe you didn't know, and chances are excellent you didn't. that if you have the audacity to collect rainwater and snow runoff on your own property for your own consumption, you can and will go to jail for it. Just ask Eagle Point, Oregon resident Gary Harrington, who recently began serving a 30-day sentence after having been convicted of that very thing. In July, Harrington was convicted of violating an obscure, arcane 1925 law because he had what state water managers described as three illegal reservoirs on his property. In the end, a court found him guilty of 9 misdemeanors, sentenced him to 30 days in jail, and levied an excess of $1,500 in fines for doing what any sane human being could never describe as criminal behavior. According to Oregon Water Resource Department, Harrington violated state water use laws by illegally diverting water running from streams into the Big Butt River. Right? Harrington begged to differ, saying he was only collecting water that flowed or melted naturally on his property, not from any particular body of water. The whole ridiculous episode began nearly a decade ago when state water managers contacted him after complaints they said they had received about the three reservoirs and he allegedly had on his 170 acres of land. Tortured explanations and ridiculous rules. State law in Oregon says all water is publicly owned. Therefore, if you want to store any of it, apparently no matter where it originally comes from, you have to obtain a permit from state water gatekeepers. And Harrington played the game, he said, and applied for 3 permits so he could comply with state law and house reservoirs for storm and snow runoff on his property. A side note, not one of the so-called reservoirs he had on his property for 37 years. He went on to say that the State Water Resource Department initially approved his permit in 2003, but then inexplicitly, the state, backed by a state court decision, reversed them. They issued me my permits. I had my permits in hand, and they retracted them just arbitrarily. Basically, they could take them back and say, no, you can't have them. So I've been fighting it ever since, Harrington told CNS News. And enter the nearly 90-year-old law, which says that nearby city of Medford holds exclusive rights to all core sources of water in the Big Butte Creek watershed and all appropriate tributaries. Though according to other regulations, water in the state is supposed to be publicly owned, hence the permit process in the first place. Way back in 1925, the city of Medford got a unique withdrawal that withdrew supposedly all the water out of the single basin and supposedly for the benefit of the city of Medford. But he continued, the 1925 law doesn't say anything about collecting rainwater or melted snow. And the withdrawal said the stream and its tributaries, it didn't mention anything about rainwater, it didn't mention anything about snow melt, and it didn't mention anything about diffused water. But yet now they're trying to expand that to include the rainwater, and they're using me as the goat to do it, Harrington said. When something is wrong, it's time to say no. And Tom Paul, Oregon Water Resource Department Administrator, maintained that indeed Harrington has violated the laws because he is allegedly diverting water away from the streams that flow into the Big Butte. But the law that he is actually violating is not the 1925 provision, but it's Oregon law that says all of the water in the state of Oregon is public water. And if you want to use that water either to divert it or to store it, you have to acquire a water right from the state of Oregon, okay, before doing that activity, he told CNS. But wait, isn't that what Harrington was doing? Moreover, Paul said 1925 law applies as well because he says Harrington constructed dams to block a Big Butte tributary, which Medford uses to supply water to its citizens. It all sounds like a tortured but poor attempt to justify unjustifiable actions and regulations. For his part, Harrington is using the episode as a constitutional teaching moment. Since when something is wrong, you just, as an American citizen, you have to put your foot down and say, this is wrong. You just can't take away any more of my rights, and from here on in, I'm going to fight it, he said. And by doing so, he's serving 30 days in the county jail. Which, you know, hey, God bless him.
Yeah.
I support his rights, and I don't know. I think I'd be doing the same thing. Yeah.
We just have about 6 minutes.
Yeah. It really, really ticks you off that, you know, something like this could actually happen to some poor guy.
People are under enough stress as it is.
Yeah.
They don't need that.
Here's a little tip for you, okay? How to combat the rise of superbugs and infectious disease with lavender.
Oh, yeah.
Did you know that?
I know lavender can do a lot. Well, there's a lot of stuff that we grow, sure.
But I think it's not very long, but I think it's a good way to possibly...
We have about 5 minutes.
But, okay, I went through that.
This is from Natural News. This is a good site, folks. Natural News. Since antiquity, lavender has been remarkably effective against life-threatening illness and infection. Today, lavender is garnering attention as a safe alternative to risky chemical disinfectants, dangerous antibiotics, and hazardous antiviral medications. As an added health-protecting benefit, lavender naturally stimulates the immune system to guard against invading bacteria and viruses. When the great epidemics of plague were sweeping through Europe during the Middle Ages and into the 17th century, what was that? A mysterious phenomenon was taking place. Tannery workers who used the essential oil of lavender in production and those who worked in lavender fields were escaping the illness unscathed. Unknown at the time, lavender boosts immunity and is a powerful barricade. As a strong...
Bactericide.
As a strong disinfectant, lavender can be utilized in a variety of ways. Up until the First World War, lavender was used on wounds and also to sterilize surfaces and equipment in hospitals. Furthermore, it is a potent antiseptic for cuts, scrapes, burns, and bites. I didn't know that. A multi-purpose germ-destroying herb, lavender is a formidable protector against infectious disease. It directly attacks bacteria and viruses through its germicidal properties. Additionally, lavender stimulates white blood cell production within the body to help fend off invading organisms. Unlike antibiotics, the lavender does not create harmful antimicrobial resistant strains of bacteria. Whether included in food or brewed as a tea, lavender is a versatile herb. Enjoying a long culinary history, lavender is a key ingredient in the French spice mess Herb de Provence. Slightly bitter and astringent in taste, lavender lends a unique flavor to edibles while maintaining all its health-giving attributes. A tea or infusion brewed with the flower is beneficial for supporting the immune system, especially during periods of stress or illness. When consumed in this way, the powerful healing properties are both ingested and inhaled for enhanced benefit. Potent tincture concentrations are also available. The essential oil of lavender can be used in a bath, combined with carrier oil applied to the skin, inhaled in steam, or simply placed on clothing. It can be mixed with a humidifier water, which assists in controlling airborne germs. Due to its concentrated nature, only a few drops are necessary and should be diluted if used on skin. Internal use of essential oils is not recommended. So that's good.
Yeah.
It's a multi-purpose germ-destroying herb.
Mm.
So when you're out there, not only does it smell great, but it also is like an antibiotic and antiseptic. It's a great thing.
So
okay.
With that, we're going to end the show tonight, and we're going to thank everybody who joined us and put up with our little computer incompetence here. My part, and I want to please invite you to join me tomorrow night when we go into the And it, when we finish, or not finish, but go into part five of the Confessions of an English Opium Eater by Thomas De Quincey. And I want to, I can't imagine, I can't believe the remarkable audiences I've been getting for that. And so I want to thank you and join me next week and have a wonderful evening. Good night. Oh, and that's tomorrow night, by the way.
Yeah, what is your music for this version? Yeah.
All right, we're still having a little difficulty here. Hang on a second. There should be. There we go. All right, folks. Have a good evening.
Good night, folks.